Hey, Smutters.
Hey.
Wow. It's been a week.
Yeah, to say the least. The week feels like it's been 6 weeks.
Yeah, y'all. We actually just got done moving, and that's why we didn't record last week, because we were waiting on the Wi-Fi and everything to get hooked up, and it's just been a mess. But now we're in our new little house, and I love it.
What a stairs.
So many stairs.
I'm at the point now, though, like, I'm getting too old to move. So, by next time, we'll definitely be hiring movers.
Yes, for sure.
Or just maybe box some stuff up. Y'all can take it.
Yes, that sounds perfect. So, this week, I have made all of us watch the Godzilla movies and the King Kong movies.
Yeah, but she didn't do it in order, though, guys. Like, she bounced around. Like, you can't do that.
Well, like, we watched one, and I was like, oh, I want to watch the others because it has to do with the story we're doing this week.
We're doing Godzilla?
Kind of.
Godzilla.
Godzilla. We are actually going to talk about Hollow Earth this week. And the way it started, I've never been interested in Hollow Earth at all. And I heard I heard a podcast about it, and I was like, this is actually really, really cool. And then we watched Godzilla, and a lot of that is about Hollow Earth. Like, that's where the Titans come from, is Hollow Earth, pretty much, right? Maybe sure. Some of them. So anyway, that was another reason why I got everybody to watch these movies, because it talked a lot about it. And I was trying to get Troy a little bit excited about the story, because I don't believe in Hollow Earth, but I think it's a neat idea, I guess is what I'm saying. What do you think?
I don't know. Because if you ever had science class, you know, and then.
Yeah, like, I mean, science pretty much proves everything, you know. And, but fun fact, they've only drilled 7 miles down into the earth.
I saw something earlier where China was trying to drill through the earth.
What?
Yeah. That, I don't know if it's true or not.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. I don't feel like they, because I believe it was Russia. They got to about the 7 mile point, and that's the furthest anybody's actually been. So, it's a very cool story. There's a lot of information, but it's very fascinating, and it does make you think. I even started looking up, were the Titans real? And, fun fact, they aren't, y'all. But yes, I'm very excited about this, and there may be some rambling, but once we get to the points, you'll get really, I hope you get excited about it like I did. I think it would be cool if it turned out to be true, but no, science just disproves everything, and, you know, maybe science will be proven wrong, and that would be very cool, but I just don't think it will be.
Yeah, probably.
All right, so let's dive on in to Hollow Earth. So what is Hollow Earth? Now, basically the theory is that the Earth is hollow and contains substantial interior space. Beliefs about the specifics of the inner Earth vary, but generally revolve around underground civilizations, technological and spiritual advancements, and alternative, even paradise-like environments. Now, supporters of this theory claim evidence to support it has been stifled by scientific communities such as NASA. So now that we know what the theory is, let's talk about several conspiracies that surround Hollow Earth. These are the fun parts, the conspiracies, I think.
Go for it.
So, perhaps the most eminent hypothesis claimed by today's believers comes from the English astronomer Edmund Halley. Now, Edmund Halley is the one that he let the world know about Halley's Comet. You You remember Haley's Comet? Mm-hmm. My dad wanted to name me Cosmo Haley after Haley's Comet. So I'm glad that my mom took it a different route. So in 1686, trying to explain shifts in the planet's magnetic field over time, he suggested that below the surface lie three concentric shells, each with poles that rotate independently and interfere with above-ground compass readings. He thought each of these nested layers was likely inhabited, their life form supported by some unknown light source. Haley's genius, rather than firm evidence, imbued the theory with some... Imbued the theory with some degree of credibility. Since then, as David Stanish explains in Hollow Earth, it has enjoyed a long and vibrant history with later generations enlarging its scope. Right down to the present, he writes, the idea has been used again and again, changing and evolving in ways that suit the needs and concerns of each succeeding time. It was one thing for Haley to speculate on the bowels of the earth, and quite another for an eccentric American trader named John Cleve Sims Jr. to seek them out. In 1818, he published Circular No. 1, both an account of his views of the subject and a vow of action. I pledge my life in support of this truth and am ready to explore the hollow, if the world will support and aid me in the undertaking. Such an undertaking seemed reasonable in light of his new contribution to the hollow earth theory. While Haley never posited a bridge to the nether regions, Sims insisted on the existence of openings at the North and South Poles, granting access to a warm and rich land, stocked with thrifty vegetables and animals, if not men. In his telling, these Sims holes span thousands of miles and curve so gently you could sail into them without noticing the transition. His evangelism mostly met with ridicule, and his dreams of government-funded expedition went unrealized. Sims never did make the trek north, but his ideas blossomed throughout the 19th century in the early science fiction works of the writers like Jules Verne, Edgar Allan Poe, who in turn inspired future believers. So, in 1908, Willis George Emerson wrote a book called The Smoky God. So, this was supposed to be the biography of a Norwegian sailor named Olaf Jansen. The book explains how Olaf's sloop sailed through an entrance to the Earth's interior at the North Pole. Now, I'm going to pause right there. Antarctica, right? There is a section in Antarctica where there is a huge hole in the Earth. Now, if I remember correctly, the majority of the heavy hitters of the world, like the U.S., Russia, all those places, they have a treaty that nobody can claim Antarctica. Antarctica is not claimed by anyone. I don't know why. It doesn't explain, but that is their treaty. Also, in the certain region of Antarctica, satellites in space are not allowed to go over it. You cannot fly over it. You cannot do anything near that place. It's kind of weird, right? And like,
I had my own satellite, people wouldn't tell me what to do with it.
I mean, there's tons of satellites in space, but yeah, none of them.
Junk up there now,
huh?
It's space is like littered with junk.
Littered with our junk. Stop it.
You did it. I did.
Stop.
My junk's in space.
Your junk's in space. But yeah, they literally, it's they are not allowed. Nobody is allowed to fly over this region in Antarctica.
The nether regions.
The nether regions.
I'm going to fly over your nether regions.
Oh my goodness. For 2 years, when they entered this interior or this entrance at the North Pole, Olaf and his father lived with the inhabitants of an underground network of colonies.
Olaf, like the snowman.
Yeah.
In Antarctica.
Okay. Emerson also wrote the inhabitants were 12 feet tall and their world was lit by a smoky central sun.
So lit.
The two men eventually left and were headed back to Sweden when their fishing boat hit an iceberg and sank. Olaf's dad drowned, but Olaf was eventually rescued. He was rescued by a whaleboat, and he was stuck on the iceberg for a couple of days. He returned home, and he was telling his uncle all about Hollow Earth, all the lands he saw, and the people he met, and how beautiful it was, and how he really needed to go back, and he wanted to take his uncle with him to see it. But before they went on the trip, Olaf's father put everything in his will to go to his son. So while Olaf is telling his uncle about all this and how magical this place is, his uncle says, you know, maybe you should go tell the Swedish government everything you just told me.
Probably should.
That's probably a good idea. So Olaf was like, okay, you know, if you really...
I'm gonna do this shit.
Yeah, he's like, I'm gonna do it. That was an exact quote. He was like, let's do this shit. I was there. He said it.
You are that old.
So Olaf decided he went and told the government everything. The government made him sign a bunch of, you know, papers about it. And as soon as he signed the papers, they threw him in an insane asylum for 28 years.
So basically as long as I've been alive.
I know, right? Now, 28 years, this time, after the 28 years was up, that was when his uncle died. So when Olaf was released, he had no inheritance left because his uncle had everything put in his name. And Olaf had nothing.
Damn. Damn thief.
I know, right?
Leave
so.
Olaf alone. He's just a snowman.
He just wants to build snowmen, okay? Where was I? Give me just a sec. That's not
it. You lost your spot.
I did lose my spot.
You're off your game.
No, I found it. I'm good. Okay. So, next, we're going to talk about William Morgan.
Ooh, he sounds like a tough guy.
I am the man whom Hollow Earth researcher Bruce Walton discovered was William Morgan, was sent to the Hollow Earth by the Freemasons with an inner earth guide through a cavern in Kentucky in 1827 called the Cave of Zoroaster?
Zoros.
Yeah, something like that. Which I believe could be the cave from which Adam and Eve emerged after being evicted from the Garden of Eden by God for having partaken of the forbidden fruit. I'm just going to stop right there. Do you think that Adam and Eve moved to Kentucky when they were evicted from Eden?
Probably, because they did some shady shit in Eden.
They did. I wonder how long it took them to get to Kentucky.
It's their fault. Well, if they went through Hollow Earth, it didn't take long.
Okay. Yeah. William Morgan returned years later from the Hollow Earth and gave the manuscript of his journey to... Our Hollow Earth to Johann Llewellyn Llangollen Drury with his promise to get it published. Johann later got his friend John Uri Lloyd to publish the manuscript as Edda Dorfa in about 1895. The book describes the conditions of the earth within the caverns, how gravity gradually decreases as you descend to the central sphere of gravity 700 miles beneath the outer surface in an 800-mile thick shell. The first 10 miles is in darkness, but below the depth, a phosphorant glow gives light to your further descent. At a depth of 150 miles, they cross a large underground lake 6,000 miles long in a skiff powered by anti-gravity. Along one side of the lake is the beginning of a volcano that erupts periodically in southern Italy. Morgan's inner earth guide explains how water spilling over a ledge from the lake causes the volcano to erupt as the water spontaneously combusts with pure space elements that the earth was made of, such as phosphorus, sodium, potassium, magnesium, and sulfur, which is what causes lava to form. And the water turned to steam is pushed out to the earth's surface. William Morgan's full name was Ward William Anthony Morgan. Let's see. Captain William Morgan wrote a book before he was sent to the Hollow Earth by the Freemasons titled The Mysteries of Freemasonry. Ward William Anthony Morgan was the husband of this person's seventh cousin, Lucinda Pendleton, six times removed.
I think we're all cousins.
Are we?
I mean, we all came from Adam and Eve, right?
Alrighty, so...
Or Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan, probably. He was. So, this next one I found very interesting because...
Or Wilt Chamberlain. He was on up there.
Too. Still going, huh?
Yep.
Okay. So, the next person we have a story about is Valiant Thor.
Your mom.
Did you just say your mom? Are you serious? Valiant Thor, you guys, we have done a story about Valiant Thor, and he always seems to show up in our other stories. Do you remember the story of Valiant Thor? The alien that, like, lived in the Pentagon for years and helped with stuff?
Is that who that is?
Yes. So, Commander Valiant Thor, head of the Council of the 12 of the Hollow Interior World of Venus, and a commander of a Venusian spaceship 7 miles long and 3 miles tall, told Dr. Frank Strangis that all the planets, including Venus and Earth, are hollow and inhabited within. Dr. Frank E. Strangis first met Commander Valiant Thor at the Pentagon in 1959. He had been there 3 years after landing in his flying saucer and requesting two policemen to be taken to the Pentagon to meet with the president. In the Oval Office, Valiant Thor gave President Eisenhower a book of instructions on how the people of Venus could help our world eliminate all sickness, poverty, and even death. After reviewing the book for 1 year, President Eisenhower returned the book to Valiant Thor, saying his advisors told him we could not accept their offer because it would destroy our economy. Now, in 1990, this person's wife, and this person, met another contactee, Howard Menger, at a UFO conference in Phoenix, Arizona. He had on display a model flying saucer he constructed outside Colorado Springs for the military with participating industry, which he test flew successfully back in the 1950s. They promised him a $1,500 check for the rest of his life. After a year, the check stopped coming. He went back to the facility near Colorado Springs where they built the flying saucer with his instructions, and there was now only an empty field. They had become an unacknowledged project and gone underground. Howard had learned how to build a flying saucer from people from Venus who had contacted him since childhood. They had come to Earth to help us and asked for his assistance. He would help them learn our customs and help them get jobs on Earth. And finally, he asked them if they would do something for him. He asked if they could take him to the moon. And they told him to meet them out in the country from his home at midnight. A flying saucer came down, and he and another man who was also waiting there boarded. When the saucer took off, Howard says he didn't feel any G-forces. They took him to an alien base on the far side of the moon, the side we never see from Earth. At this base, Howard says he met people from all the planets in our solar system. The reason NASA has not detected any life on the exterior surfaces of any planets is because they live in their interior worlds. All the planets are hollow and inhabited within. As Commander Valiant Thor told Dr. Francis E. Strangis, apparently there is a United Federation of Planets and our surface world is the only people that did not belong to it. Now, fun fact that I learned, it turns out that in one of the stories I read, I don't remember which one it was, but they were saying that Earth is actually a prison planet.
Really?
That the people on Earth, and this is why we're not part of the Federation or anything.
Was it because we stole the space cash?
The space bucks? No, it was, we are a prison planet because we are paying for what our ancestors have done. So, we're kind of garbage to space. Thanks for that.
Thanks, space.
So, next we're going to talk about my favorite one. We're talking about Admiral Byrd. And this is the story that got me into Hollow Earth because, guess what, you guys? I have his diary entries from when he visited Hollow Earth. Yes, because, well, I'll get into it after I tell y'all a little bit about Admiral Byrd. But it's so exciting. I'm getting chills. I love this story so much. Okay, so who was this man widely considered the greatest polar explorer of the 20th century, Admiral Richard Byrd? In 1925, there was a singular man on a mission to explore desolate lands rarely seen by humans to that time. Admiral Richard Byrd. He went on to become the single greatest polar explorer of the century, a feat recognized by the American government when they awarded him the Medal of Honor, the highest recognition of achievement for heroism in that country and the greatest military honor. Admiral Richard Byrd, rightly or wrongly, is now associated with the Hollow Earth concept because of some comments that were allegedly made and because of a diary that has been disputed. He was the leading pilot of his time, just missing the headlines and fame of having been the first to claim a transatlantic flight due to engine troubles. Charles Lindbergh's name is now etched in history instead. Byrd was a heroic figure, lauded worldwide as an American pilot, polar explorer, and organizer of polar logistics. Admiral Richard Byrd referred to Antarctica as the land of everlasting mystery, and of the North Pole, he said, "I'd like to see that land past the North Pole. It is the center of the great unknown." According to some, Byrd had actually found an additional world in the Hollow Earth. Though his journal was mysteriously removed by the government, what was precisely discovered has always been shrouded in mystery. But it has been astonishing. I have those journal entries, y'all, because I'm amazing. I know, but I'm so excited. Admiral Richard Byrd created a fantastic reputation in the history of the U.S. Navy. He is considered to have been an extremely brave and honest man. When he spoke out about some of the sights he had seen and experienced, governments were quick to attempt to assassinate his character. In his journal, Byrd apparently informs readers of having entered the hollow interior of the earth along with others and having traveled 1,700 miles over mountains, lakes, waterways, green vegetation, and animal life. The outside temperature recorded was 74 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, this is supposed to be in Antarctica, you guys. His airplane was welcomed by machines of a type he had never actually seen before, and his hosts informed him that he had actually been allowed to enter Agartha. Now, that is the term that they use for a city, the main city in Hollow Earth, because of his high morale and ethical status. They claim that to be the protectors of planet Earth and to protect its inhabitants from the scurrilous activities of the power brokers and nefarious government agencies with impure agendas. After the visit, Byrd and his crew were guided back to the outer area of the Earth. The inquiry that still stays is that Admiral Byrd did make a trip past the post, but this flight wasn't in February of 1947. In February of 1947, Rear Admiral Richard Byrd was in charge of a gigantic procedure in the Arctic that was called Operation High Jump. High Jump has become a contentious subject among UFO conspiracy theorists who claim it was a covert U.S. Army project to control supposed secret underground Nazi establishments in Antarctica and catch the German Vril flying disc, or the Tool, Mercury-powered spaceship prototypes. Yes, we're going to talk about the Nazis here pretty soon.
Oh, neat.
A legend among those is the know was that Adolf Hitler did not die due to a suicide in 1945, but fled to Argentina to an SS base carved under the ice in New Swabia during the very early 1950s, where he resumed his passion as a painter. According to this account, Operation High Jump, the biggest exploration ever to target the Antarctica, was organized to erase the Nazi presence at the South Pole. Some of the special reports available at the Hollow Earth shop confirm the Nazi presence in Antarctica. During World War II, it was a sanctuary for U-boats and remained one of the few areas in the oceans bereft of a strong Allied military presence. Here's the thing. Operation High Jump was actually what they told people, from my understanding, was it was supposed to be just an exercise. But they took so many people with them just for this exercise. And many people do believe that that is why they actually went to Antarctica, was to find the Nazi secret base. So it was basically them telling the world one thing and then doing another. Kind of like how it is today.
True.
In February 19th of 1947, Admiral Richard Byrd was the Navy official in charge of a gigantic operation in the Arctic, which we have alluded to as the Operation High Jump. Over 40 ships, including the Navy's crown jewel, Mount Olympus, the aircraft carrier Philippine Sea, the seaplane tender Pine Sea, the submarine Sinnet, the destroyer Bronson, the icebreaker North Wind, and other tanker and supply ships, an armed contingent of 1,400 seafarers, three dog sled teams were likewise aboard. This certainly had more of a military signature rather than an innocent exploration. Now, on January 1st of 1956, Admiral Byrd led yet another expedition to the South Pole. Admiral Byrd explained that the North and South Poles are just two of several openings in the center of the Earth. Admiral Forrestal was the first United States Secretary of Defense and among the initial founding members of the Majestic 12, an elite group of powerful government and industry leaders who were tasked with keeping an eye on all the alien activity. William Cooper goes into greater detail in the special report titled William Cooper's Deadly Secrets. The Majestic 12 was originally conceived by a man named Jesse Marcel, who had been involved with the first Roswell UFO event. The Majestic 12 was the alleged code label of a secret committee of experts, military top leaders, and government authorities, supposedly developed in 1947 by an executive order of the U.S. President Harry S. Truman. Forrestal and Byrd got into hot water by thumbing their noses at the authorities, who demanded absolute silence. They collaborated in going public with the tales regarding the Roswell accident and the internal planet. Some believe Admiral Forrestal was assassinated, and within a couple of weeks of Byrd's self-imposed expatriation, he was likewise dying. His journal was leaked after his death. All this speculation begs the question, just what happened with Admiral Byrd in the North Pole? On the 19th of September 1947, the American explorer Admiral Richard Byrd flew to the South Pole. It has been said that when he returned, he reported exactly what took place during the exploration. Conspiracy theorists have actually interpreted these written remembrances as clear evidence that Richard Byrd did actually uncover an entrance to the center of the planet. People or creatures populating the center of the Earth are some incredibly tall and very humanoid creatures that were extremely advanced. The gap in the Antarctic is said to be where these creatures fly out and fly back in. There is a hole, presumably allowing a very civilization to dwell inside the world. Past the South Pole is the great unknown. So said the great explorer, Admiral Richard Byrd. It is said that there is a U.S. regulation to prevent citizens from checking out caverns and holes in the polar region. You are forbidden to enter in a cave with an opening without a federal cave license or a government cavern expert with you. Any type of area with caves are otherwise considered to be on federal government property. Also, it was common knowledge that planes were forbidden to fly directly above the North Pole. Why is that? In 1964, Dr. Raymond W. Bernard was a leader of the Rosicrucians, who were members of a worldwide cabal, especially the ancient mystic order. Rosicrucius and the Rosicrucian order focused his research on an old magical, philosophical, and religious teachings concerned with the application of these doctrines to modern life. As we mentioned above, Admiral Richard Byrd of the United States Navy flew to the North Pole in 1926 and over the South Pole in 1929. The contention continues that Admiral Byrd did make a trip inside the North Pole entrance to the Hollow Earth in 1926. And in January of 1956, Admiral Byrd led an expedition to the South Pole. Admiral Byrd stated that the North and South Poles are the only two numerous openings to the facility of the Earth. Will this ever be confirmed? Given the iron grip on exploration now exercised by the governments, Admiral Richard Byrd proved not only a great explorer who had enough integrity to lead massive explorations of both poles, but sufficient character to tell the world what the government did not want him to reveal. And that is a hero.
He's a hero in all of us.
Now, before we go to the diary entries, we're going to go over... You're probably wondering about the Nazis, because, you know, it's weird. So, let me see. I'm looking for it. Okay, so there's a legend. Now, I don't know if you guys have heard how the Nazis had a lot to do with aliens and stuff like that. I've heard a lot of podcasts talk about how he spoke with different an alien race. And this is what gets me, you guys. The aliens that Hitler supposedly talked to, they were blonde-haired and blue-eyed aliens. Anything?
No.
Nothing? You're not going to touch it? Uh-uh. Okay. Which, it kind of turned on a light bulb in my head. I was like, maybe he thought that they were the supreme race, and that's why he started his craziness all over the world. I don't know. But there is a legend that Hitler and many of his Nazi minions escaped Germany in the closing days of World War II. Now, in case you didn't know, when they tested the DNA and stuff of the body that they found that they suppose they thought was Hitler or whatever, it had women's DNA. It wasn't male DNA. So, I think we all kind of feel like he did escape. Do you think he did?
I do.
Okay. So, what they're saying is that they fled to Antarctica, where at the South Pole they discovered an entrance to the Earth's interior. If you didn't know, the Hitler and the Nazis were into some crazy, weird-ass shit, y'all. They were into all kinds of paranormal stuff. They were into, like, magic stuff. I mean, they were also awful, awful, and crazy, and terrible. But, like, looking more into it, they were into some things. Okay? So, apparently, they had found the entrance to the Earth's interior, and according to the Hollow Earth Research Society in Ontario, Canada, they are still there. After the war, the organization claims the Allies discovered that more than 2,000 scientists from Germany and Italy had vanished, along with almost 1 million people to the land beyond the South Pole. Now, the story gets more complicated with Nazi-designed UFOs, Nazi collaboration with the people who lived in Center Earth, and the explanation for the Aryan-looking UFO pilots. While the evidence for either Hollow Earth theory is close to nil, although some folks claim to have proof in the form of photos, the story involving the Nazis, war, and the romance of exploratory adventures sounds like the makings of a great Indiana Jones story. In fact, it is! In the novel Indiana Jones and the Hollow Earth by Max McCoy, Indy comes into the possession of a mysterious journal hinting at the evidence of an underground civilization that he and the Nazis raced to find. And the fate of the world, hollow or not, is in Indy's hands. So, basically, a lot of people believe that the Nazis did run off to Hollow Earth, and that's where they pretty much stayed. And some people even think that since aging is different there, that Hitler could still be alive. So, let's get to those diary entries.
All
right. I'm so excited about the diary entries. Okay, so here's the thing. Now, after all this, the government confiscated everything that Byrd had. He managed to save his diary, and he did not talk about it. He didn't even mention it for years until he was on his deathbed. Y'all, I love a good deathbed confession. He told his son he still had his diary. So he gave his diary to his son, and his son let the whole world know about it. So here we go. I must write this diary in secrecy and obscurity. It concerns my Arctic flight of the 19th day of February in the year of 1947. There comes a time when the rationality of men must fade into insignificance and one must accept the inevitability of the truth. I am not at liberty to disclose the following documentation at this writing. Perhaps it shall never see the light of public scrutiny, but I must do my duty and record here for all to read one day. In a world of greed and exploitation of certain of mankind can no longer suppress that which is the truth. Now, it's basically a flight log and everything he saw, so at 0600 hours. All preparations are complete for our flight northward, and we are airborne with fuel, with full fuel tanks at 0610 hours. 0620 hours. Fuel mixture on starboard engine seems too rich. Adjustment made, and Pratt Whitney's are running smoothly. 0730 hours. Radio check with base camp. All is well and radio reception is normal. 0740 hours. Note slight oil leak in starboard engine. Oil pressure indicator seems normal, however. 0800 hours. Slight turbulence noted from easterly direction at altitude of 2,321 feet. Correction to 1,700 feet. No further turbulence, but tailwind increases. Slight adjustment in throttle controls. Aircraft performing very well now. 0815 hours. Radio check with base camp. Situation normal. 0830 hours. Turbulence encountered again. Increase altitude to 2,900 feet. Smooth flight conditions again. 0910 hours. Vast ice and snow below. Note coloration of yellowish nature and disperse in a linear pattern. Altering course for a better examination of this color pattern below. Note, reddish or purple color also. Circle this area two full turns and return to an assigned compass heading. Position check made again to base camp and relay information concerning colorations in the ice and snow below. 0910 hours. Both magnetic and gyro compasses beginning to gyrate and wobble. We are unable to hold our heading by instrumentation. Take bearing with sun compass. Yet all seems well. The controls are seemingly slow to respond and have sluggish quality. But there is no indication of icing. So none of the controls have ice on them anymore. 0915 hours. In the distance is what appears to be mountains. 0949 hours. 29 minutes elapsed flight time from the first sighting of the mountains. It is no illusion. They are mountains and consist of a small range that I have never seen before. 0955 hours. Altitude changed to 2950 feet and encountering strong turbulence again. 1000 hours. We are crossing over the small mountain range and still proceeding northward as best as can be ascertained. Beyond the mountain range is what happens to be a valley with a small river or stream running through the center portion. There should be no green valley below. Something is definitely wrong and abnormal here. We should be over ice and snow. To the port side are great forests growing on the mountain slopes, and our navigation instruments are still spinning. The gyroscope is oscillating back and forth. 10:05 hours. I alter altitude to 1,400 feet and execute a sharp left turn to better examine the valley below. It is green, with either moss or a type of tight-knit grass. The light here seems different. I cannot see the sun anymore. We make another left turn and we spot what seems to be a large animal of some kind below us. It appears to be an elephant. No! it looks more like a mammoth. This is incredible, yet there it is. Decrease altitude to 1,000 feet and take binoculars to better examine the animal. It is confirmed. It is definitely a mammoth-like animal. Report this to base camp. 10:30 hours. Encountering more rolling green hills now. The external temperature indicator reads 74 degrees Fahrenheit. Continuing on our heading now. Navigation instruments seem normal. I'm puzzled over their actions and attempt to contact base camp. Radio is not functioning. 11:30 hours. Countryside below is more level and normal, if I may use that word. Ahead, we spot what seems to be a city. This is impossible. Aircraft seems light and oddly buoyant. The controls refuse to respond. My God, off our port and starboard wings are a strange type of aircraft. They are closing in rapidly alongside. They are disc-shaped and have a radiant quality to them. They are close enough now to see the markings on them. It is a type of swastika. This is fantastic. Where are we? What has happened? I tug at the controls again. They will not respond. We are caught in an invisible vice grip of some type. 11:35 hours. Our radio crackles and a voice comes through in English with what perhaps is a slight Nordic or Germanic accent. The message is, "Welcome, Admiral, to our domain. We shall land you in exactly 7 minutes. Relax, Admiral. You are in good hands." I note the engines of our plane have stopped running. The aircraft is under some strange control and is now turning itself. The controls are useless. 11:40 hours. Another radio message received. We begin the landing process now, and in the moments, the plane shudders slightly and begins a descent as though caught in some great unseen elevator. The downward motion is negligible, and we touch with an only slight jolt. 11:45 hours. I am making a hasty last entry in the flight log. Several men are approaching on foot toward our aircraft. They are tall with blonde hair, and in the distance is a large shimmering city pulsating with rainbow hues of color. I do not know what is going to happen now, but I see no signs of weapons on those approaching. I hear now a voice ordering me by name to open the cargo door. I comply. End log. From this point, I write all of the following events here from memory, and it defies the imagination and would seem all but madness if it had not happened. The radio man and I are taken from the aircraft, and we are received in the most cordial manner. We were then boarded on a small platform-like conveyance with no wheels. It moves us towards the glowing city with great swiftness, and as we approach, the city seems to be made of a crystal material. Soon we arrive at a large building that is a type I have never seen before. It appears to be right out of the design board of Frank Lloyd Wright, or perhaps some more correctly, out of a Buck Rogers setting. We are given some type of warm beverage that tastes nothing like I've ever savored before, and it was delicious. After about 10 minutes, two of our wondrous appearing hosts come to our quarters and announce that I am to accompany them. I have no choice but to comply. I leave my radio man behind, and we walk a short distance and enter into what seems to be an elevator. We descend downward for some moments, and the machine stops, and the door lifts silently upward. We then proceed down a long hallway that is lit by a rose-colored light that seems to be emanating from the very walls themselves. One of the beings motions for us to stop before a great door. Over the door is an inscription that I cannot read. The great door slides noiselessly open, and I am beckoned to enter. One of the hosts speaks, "Have no fear, Admiral. You are to have an audience with the Master." I step inside and my eyes adjust to the beautiful coloration that seems to be filling the room completely. Then I begin to see my surroundings. What greeted my eyes is the most beautiful sight of my entire existence. It is in fact too beautiful and wondrous to describe. It is exquisite and delicate. I do not think there exists a human term that can describe it in any detail with justice. My thoughts are interrupted in a cordial manner by a warm, rich voice and melodious quality. "I bid you welcome to our domain, Admiral." I see a man with delicate features and with the etching of years upon his face. He is seated at a long table and he motions me to sit down in one of the chairs. After I am seated, he places his fingertips together and smiles. He speaks softly again and conveys the following. "We have let you enter here because you are of noble character and well known on the surface world, Admiral." "Surface world? I half gasp under my breath. Yes, the master replies with a smile. You are in the domain of the Ariani, the inner world of the earth, and we shall not long delay your mission, and you will be safely escorted back to the surface and for a distance beyond. But now, Admiral, I shall tell you why you have been summoned here. Our interest rightly begins just after your race exploded the first atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. It was at that alarming time we sent our flying machines, the Flugelrads, to your surface to investigate what your race had done. That is, of course, past history now. My dear Admiral, but I must continue on. You see, we have never interfered before in your race's wars and barbarity, but now we must, for you have learned to tamper with a certain power that is not for man, namely that of atomic energy. Our emissaries have already delivered messages to the powers of your world, and yet they do not heed. Now you have been chosen to be the witness here that our world does exist. You see, our culture and science are many thousands of years beyond your race, Admiral. I interrupted, but what does this have to do with me, sir? The master's eyes seemed to penetrate deeply into my mind, and after studying me for a few moments, he replied, your race has now reached the point of no return, for there are those among you who would destroy your very world rather than relinquish their power as they know it. I nodded, and the master continued, in 1945 and afterward, we tried to contact your race, but your efforts were met with hostility. Our Flugelrads were fired upon, yes, even pursued with malice and animosity by your fighter planes. So now, I say to you, my son, there was a great storm gathering in your world, a black fury that will not spend itself for many years. There will be no answer in your arms, and there will be no safety in your science. It may rage on until every flower of your culture is trampled and all human things are leveled in vast chaos. Your recent war was only a prelude of what is yet to come for your race. We here see it more clearly with each hour. Do you say I'm mistaken? No, I answered. It happened once before the Dark Ages came, and they lasted for more than 500 years. Yes, my son, replied the master. The Dark Ages that will come for now for your race will cover the earth like a pall, but I believe that some of your race will live through the storm. Beyond that, I cannot say. We see at a great distance a new world stirring from the ruins of your race, seeking its lost and legendary treasures, and they will be here, my son, safe in our keeping. When that time arrives, we shall come forward again to help revive your culture and your race. Perhaps by then, you will have learned the futility of war and its strife, and after that time, certain of your culture and science will be returned to your race to begin anew. You, my son, are to return to the surface world with this message. With these closing words, our meeting seemed at an end, and I stood for a moment as in a dream. But yet I knew this was reality. And for some strange reason, I bowed slightly, either out of respect or humility, I do not know which. Suddenly, I was again aware that the two beautiful hosts who had brought me here were again at my side. This way, Admiral, motioned one. I turned once more before leaving and looked back towards the master. A gentle smile was etched on his delicate and ancient face. Farewell, my son, he spoke, and then he gestured with a lovely, slender hand, a motion of peace, and our meeting was truly ended. Quickly, we walked back to the great doors of the master's chamber and once again entered into the elevator. The door slid silently downward, and we were once again going upward. One of my hosts spoke again. We must now make haste, Admiral, as the master desires to delay you no longer on your scheduled timetable, and you must return with this message to your race. I said nothing. All of this was almost beyond belief, and once again my thoughts were interrupted as we stopped. I entered the room and was again with my radio man. He had an anxious expression on his face, and as I approached, I said, "It is all right, Howie, it is all right." The two beings motioned us toward the awaiting conveyance, and we boarded and soon arrived back at the aircraft. The engines were idling, and we were boarded immediately. The whole atmosphere seemed charged now with a certain air of urgency, and after the cargo door was closed, the aircraft was immediately lifted by that unseen force until we reached an altitude of 2,700 feet. Two of the aircraft were alongside for some distance, guiding us on our return. I must state here the airspeed indicator registered no reading, yet we were moving along at a very rapid rate. 2:15 hours, a radio message comes through. We are leaving you now, Admiral. Your controls are free. Off Wiedersehen. We watched for a moment as the Flugelrads disappeared into the pale blue sky, and the aircraft suddenly felt as though caught in a sharp downdraft for a moment, and we quickly recovered her control. We don't speak for some time. Each man has his thoughts. There's not much more, you guys. We land smoothly at base camp, and I have a mission. March 11th, 1947. I've just attended a staff meeting at the Pentagon. I've stated fully my discovery and the message from the master. All is duly recorded. The president has been advised, and I am now detained for several hours. I'm interviewed intently by top security forces and a medical team. It was an ordeal. I am placed under strict control via the national security provisions of the United States of America. I am ordered to remain silent in regard to all that I have learned on behalf of humanity. Incredible. I am reminded that I am a military man and I must obey orders. 3-12-56, final entry. These last few years elapsed since 1947 have not been kind. I now make my final entry in the singular diary. In closing, I must state that I have faithfully kept this matter secret as directed all these years. It has been completely against my values of moral rights. Now I seem to sense the long night coming on, and this secret will not die with me. But as all truth shall, it will triumph, and so it shall. This can be the only hope for mankind. I have seen the truth, and it has quickened my spirit and has set me free. I have done my duty towards the monstrous military-industrial complex. Now, the long night begins to approach, but there shall be no end. Just as the long night of the Arctic ends, the brilliant sunrise of truth shall come again, and those who are of darkness shall fall in its light. For I have seen that land beyond the pole, that center of the great unknown. And that was his diary.
Wow.
Now, they were talking about catastrophes. Many people believe that the Atlanteans are one of the race of people that are in Hollow Earth, that that's where they escaped to when Atlantis was destroyed or whatever. There have been so many, I guess, colossal events that have almost ended the world that have made supposedly different races go into hiding into Hollow Earth. And that is what I have learned. What do you think about Hollow Earth? What do you think about the story?
The story's pretty cool.
It's a very cool story. It would be so cool if it were real.
Who's saying it's not real? You don't know.
Science. But basically they live longer there because there's no pollution. The world is just pure. And it's just supposed to be, I guess, like Eden, I guess you could say down there, you know? So, there's many different races in the world that do have their own beliefs that kind of go hand in hand with Hollow Earth. So many different races, nationalities that do have that belief. But I just wanted to let y'all in on some of the stories. I thought it was fascinating. Now, you may want to go watch King Kong and Godzilla because, boy, do they get into Hollow Earth. So I hope you guys enjoyed it. I'm sorry it was very long-winded, but I love the diary entries. I think they are so fascinating. But apparently that was his deathbed confession, you guys, and I absolutely love it. If you want to see more stories, go to ourhollowearth.com. There's more stories on there for you to read about from all kinds of different people. But I think that is enough for tonight, and I hope we see you next Sunday. Everybody layer up, drink lots of water, and
don't
make
layer
good...
up.
Yeah, don't layer up.
And don't stare into the sun tomorrow. And just
that's
FYI,
right.
FYI, if the earth can black out at 1 p.m. tomorrow, so can I.
Okay. I think is it like 3 though for us? I don't know.
I have no idea.
We need to find out because I'm so excited
It'll
about the
happen
eclipse.
When you look up and it's done.
Yeah, and I'm wanting to know what big thing is supposed to happen. y'all stay safe. Definitely wear your glasses for the eclipse tomorrow. I last time stared directly at it and almost went blind. So don't do that. All right, you guys. We'll see you next Sunday. Everybody make good choices.
Bye.
Bye.